You are listening to a talk given at the Brisbane City Bible Forum. This is the third talk in our series, God, So What? We hope you enjoy listening.
One of the things that you may have heard that gets said regularly by the intelligent media, and I'm not saying that with any cynicism, but it could be described as that, or it could be the other one where you don't need to say both, because the media is by definition intelligent, but is that people turn to God in times of difficulty. And that may be true. I think what the Bible has been saying for about 3,000 years before that is the same truth but in the opposite way, which is people turn away from God in prosperity. So one of the things that God says to the people that he drags out of slavery in Egypt and gives them this promised land, he promised it to them thousands of years ago. He couldn't give it to them because the people who lived in the land hadn't sinned sufficiently to be disqualified from being there. It's a very interesting business about God and that land. But he keeps warning them, when I bless you and give you a land full of milk and honey with wells that you didn't dig and houses you didn't make and that blossoms and grows all sorts of things, that rolls honey down the mountains and olive oil, etc., etc., be careful lest you forget me. It's always the concern that when God fills us with good things, we get all excited about the things and forget God and then walk away, rather than when hard times come, it turns us back to God. Although I think we do sometimes wake up to ourselves. Now, today I've been given what I think is a very weird topic, and a topic that frankly I didn't want to speak about, but I just defer to Glenn's intelligence, and if Glenn thinks it's a good topic, I agree.
Thanks for questioning.
Yeah. We're good friends. I may have mentioned to those of you who were here a couple of weeks ago, I went down to the International Atheist Convention earlier this year, and in some of the conversations at the coffee, etc., I introduced myself a few times to people when we talked about who we were and why we come as a lapsed atheist. And I was intrigued that nobody worked out what that meant, and they'd look puzzled, and they'd look at me and say, well, I said, you know what a lapsed Catholic is? They go, yeah. Well, I'm a lapsed atheist. I was an atheist, and I've fallen away from the faith. And I've come here to hear if the arguments given by the collection of the four horsemen, although one of them had died before he got there, the three and a half horsemen, and watching the up-and-comers, I think, jostling to be the next one on the horse, was just to see if they had better arguments, and which they didn't particularly, than the books that they'd written. But when I became a Christian, as I've shared with you, and be happy to do this in the question time, for me, it was entirely a decision based on what was true. I didn't want God. I didn't need God. I didn't like the idea of God. I didn't like Christians. I hated church, although I'd hardly ever been for decades. But I knew it stank because everyone in Australia knows that church is dull. You don't need to go. But I became a Christian very reluctantly. In fact, the night when I prayed the prayer of turning around, changing the way I lived, it was an angry prayer. Imagine that you were having the most exciting time of your entire life in this room. Now, I know you're not, although the food is good, and there's some nice people here. But imagine you were having the most exciting, the most pleasurable, the most secure, restful time you've ever had in your life, and a couple of policemen come up, and a fireman, and a few other people, and they say, quick, get out of here. This building's about to be blown up. Now, it doesn't really matter how much pleasure we're having in this room, you'd leave, even with some reluctance. And that was exactly how I became a Christian. I was having a terrific life. It was fun. I was just looking. It was getting better and better. And really, I think when I look back on it, I think I was a Christian for the first year or two with a grudge against God. I was really unhappy that I had to become... It was a little bit like I've got a daughter who's diabetic. Now, she doesn't enjoy being a diabetic. I mean, we're thankful to live in a country where the insulin is so supported by the taxes of the Australian people. It's very expensive stuff. But she doesn't enjoy being a diabetic, but she is a diabetic, so she just has to live with it. You know, you've got to do the maths calculations and prick your finger and needle yourself and all that sort of stuff. And you just live with stuff that's true or die, like AIDS. We should take AIDS for granted, but if you're as ancient as I am, and when suddenly AIDS hit the scene, and we suddenly had this disease that could kill you quite easily and wiped out thousands and thousands of particularly young men in Sydney, you've just got to live, it's real. And so that's why I became a Christian. And which is why I've had a lot of trouble being patient with the notion that people just become Christians because they need to invent a God. It was, for me, it was the exact opposite experience. Then I remember getting to know God a little bit over the years, and that's what being a Christian is. It's only entirely secondary as an ethical moral system. It's about a relationship with the person. At least that's the claim that Jesus makes. I remember I got to the point where the only way I can describe it is I fell in love with God. I actually remember hearing myself saying in a prayer, "I love you." And I kind of stepped back from the prayer, because when I'd been in little groups with Christians as they prayed about things, and sometimes they would talk about loving God, I remember thinking, "Shut up, you liar. No one can love God. There is nothing..." This is the thing. I think men may be more in danger of this than women. That's sexist, isn't it? Some of us do this, where you assume if you don't understand it, it is not comprehensible. If you have not experienced it, it is unreal. It's a remarkably limited way. But I just assumed that when these people who were Christians, like I was, and at similar stage of life, when they talked about loving God in prayer, I just assumed they were lying. Because I thought there was nothing lovable about God. I could see why I would love my girlfriend. I would see why I'd love my mother. I endured my father. But love for God just seemed weird. And that was... then. Hanging around him for a few years, you discover that the God that Jesus reveals, the God who is really there, is entirely lovable. In fact, not to love him simply betrays our blindness and the fact that there is a whole world of what the real God is like, who is entirely lovable. And it's this relationship. So for some years now, I've been in the position of thinking that if God suddenly spoke from heaven, which he doesn't do except in Monty Python movies. I think he's done it two or three times in history, according to the Bible. It's not a common occurrence. And he ain't going to do it for little old Ian Powell. But if God was to speak from heaven and say, "Right, change of plans. From now on, when everyone dies, they're just food for worms." Right? That's it. It's not that I don't exist, because you can certainly have a God that's there and not have life after death. He can do what he likes with his creation. So from now on, it's just death. I would still want to tell people, you want to get to know Jesus and you want to get to know the God who is there, because it's actually rich and right and good, and it's what humans are made for. We're all looking for stuff. We're all looking for a job and a life that's worth doing, that's worth getting out of bed for. Apparently, I listened to the Apple spokesman. That's what working at Apple does. Seriously? I'm not saying it's not a bad job, but, you know, the most exciting job in the world. It's a reason to get out of bed to make Apple products. I don't think so. And we're all looking for love too, and even men are looking for love. At least one person who values us and treasures us. And Jesus would say all those things are because of the way God has made you, and they're ultimately found in connection with God. Now, why would anybody want a God? Well, it depends on the picture that you have of God. There are many gods that are worth killing. Many of the festivals that Australian white fellas observe other cultures doing that look so much fun are actually generated by fear. It's not without reason that when you look at some various temples and places, the images of the gods are quite terrifying. We just think they're kind of quaint. My Chinese friends tell me that a lot of what we like about the Chinese New Year festival with gongs and bells and dragons is actually to frighten away bad spirits. It looks good. It looks fun. You know, if you're just a brainless white Australian who's got nothing else to celebrate, Chinese New Year, you'll do fine. Yugoslavian Independence Day, why not? You know, whatever. We've got nothing really to celebrate, so let's just... Halloween! I mean, seriously? I mean, anyhow. But what the Bible's saying is that there is a God who, if you get to know him, is both frightening and traumatic to meet, because it's a civil war. The government of your life is overthrown and replaced by a far better. So the psalm I thought I'd just draw your attention to ever so briefly is Psalm 23. It's probably one of the best known bits of the Bible. If you went to a private school, you probably sang it. I won't sing it because I love you and I'm commanded by Jesus to love my neighbour. But the whole psalm, it's a very short psalm, 6 verses. It all hangs on this first statement: "The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing." The next 5 verses are just working this into different areas of life. If you get this part, you get it. If you miss this part, you missed everything. Now, when I became a Christian, I would have said, "The Lord is my boss," with all the hostility that Australians and 19-year-old boys have towards bosses and those in authority. He was my boss. He was bigger than me. He owned the company. He owned the world. He was going to have me on a sort of performance evaluation at the end of my life. Like it or not, he was my boss. And the trouble with this boss is one of the reasons why people don't like believing in God is because he sees everything. He can't hide from him. I've worked for all sorts of bosses where I've found places I can sleep when they thought I was working and all sorts of things. But this boss, no secrets. Every word, every thought being known. And for me, it was a movement from this recognizing that the Lord is my shepherd. Now, the problem with saying the Lord is my shepherd, what sort of creature is writing this psalm? Well, the guy who wrote this, sorry?
A sheep.
Sheep. I don't respect sheep. I like sheep. I like eating them. Since one of my daughters developed an allergy to cow products, I've discovered they even make nice cheese. They're a very useful animal, very valuable animal. And in the world where Jesus lived, in Palestine, and where the psalm was written, you didn't tend to keep sheep to kill them. You kept them for the wool, you kept them for the milk, and all sorts of other things you could get from them. They were a very valuable animal, but they were also very tasty. And so there were human robbers who were keen to steal them because they were valuable. But in the place where this psalm was written, in ancient Palestine, ancient Israel, you had bears, wolves, and lions. And you put up the biggest, strongest, meanest kung fu trained sheep against a moderately not dead wolf, bear, or lion. I'll tell you where I'm putting my money. And the Palestinian lion was only wiped out in the last 100 years. It has some quite distinctive features. But it could. And so to have to be a sheep, you need a shepherd or you're nearly extinct. Sheep do wander off and they have a nice time, roughly for about a day. They don't normally last a night in the Middle East or in that ancient Middle East. They might nowadays, because now we've managed to wipe out most of the scary animals. But so this is a guy who's saying, look, I'm like a sheep and God is like my shepherd. Now, the guy who's writing this is not some psychological weakling, which you might think, oh, there's a pathetic person, needs to invent, you know, someone up there to care for him. This is King David who writes this. And David is a nasty piece of work in some ways. David is an alpha male, far too much testosterone. If you've been to Florence, you know he's good looking and very big, because there's a statue of him that must be accurate. And he was a magnificent athlete, a very handsome man. The women loved him. He killed people quite ruthlessly at times and subsequently genuinely repented. But it was a nasty piece of work. Had all sorts of adventures, military leader, led a guerrilla warfare for some time, was hunted. I mean, this guy has lived. The stuff that we play in computer games, he's actually doing it. But he's no fool. He knows in the end, and this is something where, I will say this is sexist, but where men tend to be more cowardly than women, men hide from the fact that we are very weak and vulnerable. We don't go to doctors, not because we're brave, but we're too gutless to get the diagnosis often. We'd rather die of slow cancer than have tests of unpleasant things done to us, right? And men think they've coped by death by not thinking about it and making a joke about it and hiding behind a beer. That's called denial. And as I say, that's not just a river that flows through the Egypt. It's a constant psychological game we play where we pretend to hide from ourselves unpleasant stuff. You are a weak and pathetic little creature. You'll be dead before you know it. And the things that can kill you are so tiny, so small, right? You can barely see them. Right? We are very vulnerable. I'm 57. I've had any number of friends die. Looking back, I should have died any number of times as I was growing up. And it wasn't because I was tough. It was just that I was lucky. It was just that when the car crumpled at 90-something miles an hour when I ran into a DMR caravan, it just, I don't know how we didn't die, frankly. But we delude ourselves. We are weak, we are vulnerable, we are like sheep. I've had a long argument with a friend of mine who grew up on a sheep farm and then was in charge of the vet faculty at Sydney University. I used to say sheep are stupid. He said, Ian, they're not really all that stupid. The problem with sheep is they do not know who to trust. They're easily frightened and they don't know who to trust. Now, this is exactly true with humans. King David was man enough to admit it. Many of us get taught from a time where little boys and sometimes little girls to pretend that we are not weak and vulnerable, and often we don't know who to trust. So we believe all sorts of silly things. King David has worked out that though he's powerful amongst men, he's also very weak. So he says, the Lord is my shepherd, the conclusion, I will lack nothing. And if you have a look at the psalm, you can find it on your computer, on the internet, type in Psalm 23, just type in the Lord is my shepherd, it'll pop up in 1,000 different forms. He then goes through and works out different areas of life. And just touching on them briefly, he says, the Lord is my shepherd. Kind of there's an implicit therefore I lack nothing. Because the shepherd is the king of the flock. He leads it where it goes. He's the guide. He's the guardian. He's the doctor. He's the psychologist, because sometimes flocks they squabble. He sorts them out. I'm in this relationship with the creator of man, the universe. He makes me lie down in green pastures, leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. That's a beautiful word. This is what God is doing. I didn't know this when I became a Christian. I just thought God wanted to oppress me. But what he's doing is refreshing or restoring human souls. I don't know if you've ever done this with a bit of furniture or an old car. I tell you what, they're never going to restore IKEA furniture. I see the place of IKEA in the great universal scheme of things, but in 100 years' time, except as a joke, no one restores IKEA furniture because it's made from rubbish. Right? Well, I understand there are levels within the IKEA thing. My wife has educated me somewhat on this. But you restore something that's inherently valuable. Down in Sydney, one of the things to do, if you ever have to come down to Sydney, is to go out in the James Craig. It's a fantastic story of a magnificent ship that was left a hulk in Tasmania and then was restored. And now you can see it. And I've been on it. It's fantastic. You can feel it live with the sails and that. That's what God's doing. He's taking us, damaged as we are, partly by our own stupidity and sin, partly by the sin of evil of others, and partly because of the foolishness of the society we live in. He wants to restore you to be fully, truly, deeply human. That's what he's doing. And if you have a look at the next verse, this is the verse that I found really helpful. Well, that's gone invisible. Is that a cue that I've spoken for too long? Verse 4. One of the things people hope sometimes is if they get caught up with God, God will protect them from the hard times. The Bible never promises that. In fact, it generally says it'll probably be harder, but it'll be different. King David says this, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of the valley of death, I fear no evil, for you're with me. Sheep hate going through valleys, but a good shepherd will often take them through from one set of grass in sort of Palestine. That shepherd has to know, okay, this is where the rain's been coming, so they can feed here for a week, then I'll take them out to this pasture here. Often they have to go through a dark valley. There's a good reason for it, but the sheep hate it. Sheep like being in open space where they can see things. Wolves, bears, lions, thieving humans hide in the shadows. They hate shadows. When they design abattoirs, they've got to be careful about shadows because they can frighten sheep and cattle sometimes. But they don't like being amongst the shadows. And David says, even when I have to go through the worst of times, when it feels like 100 different deaths are happening, and there are a number of ways in which death can hit you long before death hits you, and you feel, oh, this is killing me. And this is killing all my hopes for life. When you go through those times, and the Bible promises you will, just how you go through them, to go through it knowing, as I discovered a few years ago, that he's with me in it. I want him to be so with me that he'll lift me over the valley. I want a helicopter, pick me up from pasture A to pasture B. Jesus never promised. He doesn't turn us into soft weaklings. He strengthens us. And then all the way through to the last and the big picture that we've talked about, our culture's denialism, is the question of eternity. No one can claim to be an honest realist who doesn't look death in the face. You can avoid taxes. You cannot avoid death. Here's the ones, you hear people talk about their superannuation and what they're going to do when they retire, and then they die before they get there. I've had friends that's happened to. Doesn't happen to most of us. I'm not suggesting most of us are going to do it. I'm not saying don't put your money in the superannuation fund. Do whatever you like with that. But I'm saying we plan for our retirement, which is a possibility. Many of us have never had a serious discussion with anyone about the certainty of death. David is too much of a man to pretend that, so he talks about it. He knows in the end that having lived as God's friend in the now, this friendship will continue. If, on the other hand, you choose to treat God as your second cousin from Whoop Whoop, that you don't want to know, and you may just say hello to them at some funeral, but you really have no desire to know them, well, God won't force you. You can go into an eternity on your own. But one of my favourite writers from some time ago was dying, and he was John Owens, and he was writing letters through a secretary, and the secretary was writing and he said, dear so-and-so, as you can see, I'm still in the land of the living. Then Owen thought for a while, he said, no, cross that out. He said, as you can see, I'm still in the land of the dying. I hope soon to arrive in the land of the living, which he did. And so in the end, that's not morbid. See, the weird thing in our culture, you talk about this great certainty, and I can hear voices in my head saying, don't be so morbid, don't be so realistic. So why is it worth knowing God? Well, because we all like to meet good, loving, interesting, exciting people. And that is exactly what you find in the God that Jesus reveals. And it enables you to live well through the hard times and through the prosperous times, and to look at the whole story. Last thing before we throw it out for questions. In Lord of the Rings, which I'm now starting to read. I've watched the movies. I thought I didn't need to buy the books. But someone was throwing the books out in the units I live in. There was the three of them. So I thought, oh, I might take those and read them. But I watched the movies. But there's a part which is in the books as well where Sam and Frodo are walking. It's the end of the second movie. They're walking and Sam says to Frodo, Mr. Frodo, you know, what sort of story do you think we're living in? And it's an interesting question because there are classically two sorts of stories, tragedies and comedies. And tragedies, they can have all sorts of ups, but they finish up there. And that's what human life is. That's why so many of our great thinkers have been fundamentally deeply despairing. Because whatever you value, everyone you value, it all finishes in death. I discovered when I became a Christian reluctantly, because the evidence pushed me there, that you end up being part not of a tragedy, but of a comedy. And a comedy doesn't mean you giggle a lot, which is the way it means, but a comedy has got the J curve that Paul Keating used to talk about, where you go down, but then it goes back up. And this is what it's like being caught up with the God that Jesus brings into our experience. Someone who will love you, you have a satisfied mind, but you can look at the whole picture.